Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and continued fallout, recriminations, conversations prompted by what President Trump had to say, the State of the Union address. Holding fast on his demand for border security funding. And, you know, we're on a less than a 10-day clock now. It was interesting. CBS, who had the flashball right after the State of the Union, that found three-quarters of Americans approved of what the president had to say generally and specifically on immigration. That was sort of interesting. But they had a little makeshift focus group. Five adults at Drake University, Iowa caucus voters, two Democrats, two Republicans of sort, we'll get to that, and one independent. Here's how one Republican voter described, one Republican Iowa caucus voter described the president's speech.
You come out, you talk about unity, then you talk about how great America was, and then you talk about risk and sacrifice. And so it's like, ride the surfboard to glory with me, because that's where we're going if you choose to get on board.
Yeah, I think that's not an unfair description. I would add that he also, the president, pointed out some of the things that have been accomplished in the last 2 years. And if you're a Republican primary voter, you think of important steps that have been taken to advance deregulation. You think about judicial appointments. You think about tax relief. You think about, depending on your perspective, on America's role in the world, the principled realist approach to foreign policy that is reducing troop commitments around the world. So there are substantive things, too. It's not just all abstractions. The interesting thing was on immigration, though. And you had you heard from a Democrat farmer, and he took up the issue of labor as it pertains to immigration. And then you heard from an independent voter on the system generally. Here's the farmer.
Aaron, you're a fifth-generation farmer. You have lived here in Iowa all of your life. Why are immigrants important to you?
We're a country of immigrants. I think there's room to make it so that we have a fair path for people to come to this country. We have a big need in Iowa for labor, and that's important to Iowa farms to have reliable labor. So I don't buy that it has to be one extreme or the other. I think there's a fair path in between.
It's interesting, just because he's a Democrat caucus voter, and he's talking essentially about this, you know, middle position. And it seems to me what he's indicating is support for the middle position that Trump articulated a couple weekends ago.
Yeah.
Which provides the path,
and especially
in part,
because
that he's talking about.
Molly Tibbetts. I mean, she was murdered by somebody here who was working in Iowa illegally. And that's why, you know, if we're going to do it, we should do it the right way, the legal way, rather than people just crossing over the border. Because we can't check them or verify. And he killed her because she said, I'm going to call the police on you, and he knew he would get deported.
Right, the security issue, and that's a good setup for what the alleged independent voter had to say about the system generally, personalizing it to her six-year-old grandchildren.
Problem is that the system is archaic. To do the legal thing is not as easy as people think. But people are fleeing because dismembered bodies of children appear every day in the streets. I have 2 6-year-old grandchildren who are beautiful, and I love them dearly. And if their life was in danger, I would do anything to save them.
It's interesting because you have to remember this is how people personalize complicated policy discussions. You know, what would be in my interest? What would I do if I was in their position? And I don't begrudge her that position. If my nephews were in that position, would I do the same thing? Of course I would.
Or your fictitious children. Don't forget about them.
My imaginary children. I would do anything for my imaginary children.
Right.
You know that. But so here's the question, though, because this will come up in conversations within your social circles. So what do you say when somebody who's a friend of yours, acquaintance, colleague, says something like that woman says? What do you say? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And it's the same thing with the farmer. Yeah, I get it. Your interest is in the labor supply you need to farm your land.
Yeah.
And your interest is in thinking about what would I do for my children or grandchildren if I was in the position of a Guatemalan migrant or a Mexican migrant or some other Central American migrant or anybody from the world over. And I guess my response would be to say, here's the deal. How do you translate your position with respect to your grandchildren into public policy, into the law of the land? Do you think we should just have open borders and no security, and we'll just trust people who are coming to this country that all of them are fleeing oppression, threats of violence to protect their children or grandchildren? We'll just take that as an article of faith. I don't think very many people are going to say, well, that's a reasonable position. Because the reality on the ground tells us different. So if that's not a reasonable position, here's the deal I have for you. You, the farmer, and you, the woman thinking about if my family was in the position of a Central American migrant's family. If you help me get control of our border so there is a sensible process to allow people coming to this country to make themselves, to have a better life for themselves, make themselves better, as it were, and make the country better by extension, then I'll do you this solid. We'll have it set up so that we can expedite these processes. We can handle more asylum cases more quickly. We can provide pathways in, not just for temporary worker programs, perhaps, as needed, as demonstrably needed, but also a citizenship processing. When you play by the rules that we set up, there's no reason it needs to take a decade plus to become an American citizen if you prove up that the laudable reason you're coming to this country was indeed the reason. How about that deal? But I can't do what you want done to help people that are similarly situated in terrible countries and similarly disposed to be good people doing good things, productive things. I can't do that if you're going to support lawlessness at the border.
That sounds reasonable.
But it's perfect. And I just think you have to confront these conversations because that woman talking about her grandchildren, she's not wrong.
No.
And it's not, it's fine to have empathy to put yourself in the shoes of someone else. But you have to translate that. We're having a public policy discussion.
Right. But I wouldn't risk my kid's life making the journey here.
Well, it depends on your circumstance, right? I mean, you could be risking your life. It could be a greater risk of your life to stand in place in some places. And I think that's the point she's making. Tom in Oswego, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, you talked about policy discussion. But we have to start with the correct language. The farmer, I listened to the clip, the farmer says that we need immigrants. Well, nobody's arguing that.
Right.
It's illegal immigrants is the problem, the illegal portion of it. And once we start talking more about the illegal part of this, then we can have a better discussion. But you always hear that Trump is against immigration, period.
Right. Yes. Thanks for the call.
Which is wrong.
Well, that's right. And he made that explicit yesterday. I want to welcome more immigrants than anybody. More immigrants. And the other thing, too, going back to what Trump had to say versus what we're hearing, people are looking at their short-term interests. So the cultural Marxist left wants illegal immigrants for votes, and the effete GOP donor class, some members of it, want illegal immigrants for labor, to lower their labor costs. But I think the point of welcoming the huddled masses yearning to be free is to serve their long-term interest by treating them as a three-dimensional human being and, by extension, serving America's long-term interest for generations. I think that's the point. And it's completely lost in these discussions and, as Tom points out, in the sort of bastardization of Trump's position by the left and too many effete GOP donors on the so-called right. Carl in Temple, Texas.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to say, you know, the farmer wants immigration. He does immigrants, not illegal, but legal immigrants. But we have to have them. And that lady with her, if she has children, if that pixie dust and unicorn, it's that simple. It's not a realistic situation. So we just get it past it. And I'd like to say that people don't talk about the part about this illegal and legal immigration. These people suck uncanny billions off of our entitlement programs. And even after they've been here six to eight years, people between 24 and 40, somewhere in that range, 60% of them are still on entitlement programs.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Carl. I mean, the whole entitlement program is endemic to America right now because of our concession to the welfare state. And by the way, a lot of Republicans and erstwhile conservatives don't want to touch bankrupt entitlement programs, pyramid schemes either, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. It's a larger conversation. And as I've said before,
well, you have the best idea.
Yeah, one other feature of it, you want to come in to work? Okay, work. You waive off all entitlement benefits, welfare state benefits, and you at least until you run through the processes to become a citizen. And then you're treated like everybody else, and you're part of this larger conversation about what we do about unfundable entitlement programs. Bruno in Naperville.
Yeah, a couple things. One, the argument that people use about, hey, you know, what do you do with this situation where you have this oppressed person in some country where there's violence or poverty? There's 3 billion people in the world who would fit that category, and we don't have room for 3 billion people. That's number one. Number two, the situation we're in right now, if you look at American history, is kind of where we were around 1920 after the massive waves of immigration from Italy and Eastern Europe and places like that. And there was a backlash going on back then that, hey, we have too many people. They haven't assimilated yet. We need to take time. We don't have an economic need for them here right now like we did in the 1880s and 1890s. And if you look, if you go on usgovernment.gov and you look at immigration statistics in the 1920s and 1930s, there were very few people coming into this country because the country took a hiatus from immigration. And 20 years later, it was the assimilated children of those immigrants who went and won World War II. But we took a break from it.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Bruno. I'm not sure I you know, the government knowing just how many immigrants to take in on an annualized basis, that's the same government that we don't trust to have the secret knowledge to set prices or wages. So let's just be careful about the government, you know, these people that are superheroes in this nebulous entity called government, knowing just exactly what the numbers are, when we should be taking hiatuses and not. Let's set a policy based on our first principles and based on fair, transparent processes rather than throwing darts at a board like politicians do about what the magic numbers are. That's a different type of magical thinking as far as I'm concerned. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, to that woman, I would say, you know, the children you're talking about, they're not your grandchildren. Your grandchildren are here in America and everything like that, and you love them and you want to keep them safe and everything like that. And the situation that's going on is creating unsafety, instability in our social services and jobs. Okay, it's a negative effect on our grandchildren who are here in America. So she's thinking the wrong thing, basically.
Okay, thanks for the call, Craig. But you understand why people would put themselves empathetically in the position of another human being. That's not an uncharitable thing to do.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
That's enough. Put down the mic.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The Virginia Minstrel Party is running out of possible replacements to Ralph Northam.
Yeah, what a day. You thought it couldn't get worse for Virginia. And then Wednesday happened. And a lot was going on. Where do you want to start?
Well, the latest, well, a couple new developments, but just the latest Amos and Andy acolyte is the Attorney General, Democrat named Mark Herring, who issued a state. And this, by the way, Mark Herring has called for Ralph Northam's resignation.
Right.
So just keep that in mind when you hear Mark Herring issuing a statement acknowledging he wore brown makeup and a wig in 1980 to look like a rapper during a party when he was a 19-year-old undergrad at UVA.
Yeah, he said he was 19 at the time, but he and his friends listened to Curtis Blow at the time, and they were going to perform a song at the party.
Is that the song they were going to perform?
I don't know if it's this one. Do you like this one?
I remember that.
I know every word to the song, which is very sad. Or, hold on, ready? Ah, we couldn't get to it in time. But here's the Breakers.
Yeah, yeah.
I think this is the one they're going to do.
That's the Breaks, not the Breakers.
Oh, the Breaks. Breaks to win and break to lose. It's easy to break to rock your shoes.
And these are the Breaks. Break it up, break yeah. it up, break it up. I appreciate that Curtis Blow was sort of a pioneer in rap, but it wasn't necessarily the best rapper that the 80s produced. And here's the thing. I mean, all these, white dorks that wanted to imitate rappers, didn't they ever hear a third bass? If they would have just imitated a third bass, they would have never gotten in trouble. Find the white rapper.
Third bass?
You never heard of Pop Goes the Weasel?
Oh.
Pop Goes the Weasel because the weasel goes pop. One of the great all-time lyrics.
Well, I remember the Beastie Boys. I mean, weren't those they considered rap?
Yeah, it's a little later on, though.
Is this it? Pop goes the pop, goes the wine,
and then the weasel. I see the empty pocket needs a refill. I got a squad with a lot of people. And the one guy walked around with a cane, like a walking stick. Remember that guy? Yeah.
Yeah, so they didn't have to dress up.
They could have dressed up as those two white guys from Pop Goes the Weasel, and they could have avoided all this political controversy.
Well, he said, because of our ignorance and glib attitudes, we do not have appreciation for the experience or perspective as others at the time. And we dressed up and put on wigs and brown makeup, Dan. Not black makeup, brown.
Yeah.
So is he going to
distinction
have to
without a difference.
So what do we do here?
I guess we're looking for who's fourth and next to the governor? Fifth? Let's start lining people up just because we don't know how deep we're going to have to dig to get a new governor in Virginia.
They better have a deep bench. Well, the next in line is Republican House Speaker Kurt Cox, who I'm sure they're all going through his yearbooks from middle school and on to make sure he didn't dress up inappropriately or he didn't touch anybody inappropriately.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure Democrats are enthusiastic about the prospects of a Republican replacing Northam.
No.
Interestingly, Northam is actually toying with the idea of replacing himself by leaving the Democrat Party, becoming an independent, so he doesn't have to deal with the calls from Terry McAuliffe and others to resign.
That's awesome.
And then number two,
the
lieutenant
governor.
The deuce,
they call him?
Yeah, well, he is the deuce, according to Vanessa Tyson. Justin Fairfax not handling the sexual assault allegation against him particularly well. NBC News reporting that Fairfax, in a private meeting on Monday night, while referring to his accuser, Vanessa Tyson, who's a professor now.
I hope he showed her respect.
He said, F that B.
Well, it happened when he was an aide to, of all people, John Edwards, and was at the Democratic Convention in
2004 in Boston.
2004. Well, yeah. Vanessa Tyson has come forward. She's a college professor, and she released a detailed statement yesterday about what exactly happened. What began as consensual kissing quickly turned into a sexual assault. Mr. Fairfax put his hand behind my neck and forcibly pushed my head towards his crotch. Only then did I realize that.
That's one of those words.
I know.
It's like moist.
Oh, okay. Ugh. Unbuckled his belt, unzipped his pants, and taken out his penis. He then forced his penis into my mouth, utterly shocked and terrified.
Wow.
I tried
hello.
To
what? Hello.
I asked you during the break if I could read what he did.
You could have characterized it. You can, you know.
Well, he was good much Lord. Stronger than me, and as I cried and gagged, that's another word, Mr. Fairfax forced me to perform oral sex on him. I cannot believe, given my obvious distrust, that Mr. Fairfax thought his forced sexual act was consensual. To be very clear, I did not engage in blank sex with Mr. Fairfax, and I never gave any form of consent.
Okay.
Quite the opposite.
Okay, E.L. James, thank you for that reading.
And she's never spoken to him again. She avoided him for the remainder of the convention, and so that whole thing, he came forward and said, well, she asked to meet my mom, and she wanted to come visit me. That, and according to her, is not true.
She also said, after the assault, I suffered from both deep humiliation and shame. I didn't speak about it for years. She suppressed memories, emotions as a necessary means to continue her studies, pursue a goal of building a career as an academic. She said, I found this horrific incident especially degrading given my regular volunteer work at a local rape crisis center. And then over the next decade or so, I would go on to earn a PhD from U of C, University of Chicago, become a tenured professor at Scripps College, and years later, I saw a picture of him in an accompanying article about his campaign for lieutenant governor of Virginia and so on and so forth, bringing us to this point. So credible enough for an investigation? I mean, based on the Kavanaugh standard that was set by Democrats?
Oh, and speaking of Kavanaugh, the lieutenant governor has hired Brett Kavanaugh's attorney, and Vanessa Tyson has hired Christine Blasey Ford's attorney. So here we go again.
Tony in Downers Grove with an admission. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, I think I could run for office, Dan, because in grammar school, I dress as a ballerina for trick-or-treat, and I think in today's climate, this would be very acceptable.
Well, yeah, that would be acceptable. That's right. I mean, we had a mayor who dressed as a ballerina well into his college years.
He majored in dance. He was a ballerina.
That's a story. Okay. I know. That's the cover story.
Somebody tweeted this out. What if a politician did blackface and ended up getting murdered by revenge-seeking Liam Neeson?
Well, that would be a sort of street but justice, I guess.
Am I missing? Like, we didn't dress up in blackface. I don't remember ever seeing anybody dressed up in blackface. And I really wonder what Megyn Kelly would think of all this, because remember she got fired for talking about blackface.
What is racist? Because truly, you do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface for Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Like when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, Megyn Kelly didn't get fired for that. They were looking for a reason, and she provided it. But what if you dress up as Jimmy Kimmel dressing up as Karl Malone?
Or Oprah Winfrey. He dressed up as Oprah Winfrey once.
Yeah.
Or Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon dressed up as Chris Rock. Remember that skit?
Right.
And then there's Robert Downey Jr., who wore blackface in Tropic Thunder.
What if you dress up as Julie Andrews as Mary Poppins as a chimney sweeper and she's got some soot on her face? Is that acceptable? There is this point, and Coleman Hughes makes it in National Review about the art of retroactive repudiation. Here's the thing. The yearbook police, you know, watching what's going on in Virginia is not an endorsement of the yearbook police. At least not from my perspective. I just want to make that clear. But it is a lesson about the yearbook police coming forward, the yearbook police, Northam, Fairfax. I don't know this Herring guy, but I assume he threw in with everybody as well when it came to Kavanaugh or anybody else on the right. And we do know Herring because he called for Northam to resign when he had done the very same thing Northam did effectively, or at least partially. So it's not an endorsement of the yearbook police. And it's not, you know, zero tolerance for anybody who's ever put on blackface to play Othello, right?
Wait.
In a Shakespearean production. That person should have no career, should be ostracized from society.
Fred Armisen did it on SNL to impersonate Barack Obama.
Correct. And so context matters. And even where the context is, makes it clear the person was tone deaf or ignorant. That is not a sin punishable by banishment, okay? So I just want to separate the two. What we're really talking about here is a bunch of leftists that have been hoisted by their own petard. And so I'm enjoying that. And it's instructive. And hopefully people that are rushing to end other people, rushing to, you know, virtue signal on the political and professional graves of others, will think this through a little bit more. But in terms of any sympathy for Northam or these other Democrats, well, that's not coming. No. So there's two separate issues that have right. to be addressed, is my point.
I just like that idea that he's going to become an independent, or he's thinking about it, the current governor.
Oh, Northam, yeah.
Northam.
You can't kick me out of your party. I'm not in your party.
I kicked myself out of your party. That's fantastic.
Mike in Union.
Hey, good morning, everybody. A little flashback to the 80s. I'm going to blame this all on C. Thomas Howell. Do you remember the movie Soul Man?
Of course. Yes. That's how he got into Harvard.
That's probably why all these white dorks are doing this, so I just wanted to drop that on you.
Thanks for the call. That's another good one.
That was a good one. What about the movie White Chicks? Did you ever see that?
No.
Two black guys dressed up as blonde white chicks.
Yeah, one of the Wayans brothers,
yeah,
right?
It was a grid. It was actually, I saw it a few times.
Oh, so what?
I loved it. I thought it was funny.
I mean, and by the way,
Marlon Wayans.
The two things are not equal because the history of minstrel shows,
yeah,
right? I mean,
right.
So let's just make that clear
all
as well.
All right, fine. No, I just wanted to remind people to see White Chicks.
Yeah, but should C. Thomas Howell be banned? Should we have a DVD burning party for Soul Man? I mean, let's get a hold of ourselves. That's Greg and Schomburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, I feel really ancient with all of your allusions here as a 1972 grad who wrote 20% of the annual. And literally one of the hardest parts of doing that was sitting there looking at pictures and coming up with cut lines that were funny. This is not fair to these people. That's the process. You know, there's a team of people that sit there and make these things up. And it's really not fair to go back to people and attribute that to their personality.
Oh, you mean for yearbooks? It's the yearbook specifically.
Yeah, in other words, we were a team of people. We literally sat there for hours trying to come up with funny lines
right.
that would work 40 years, 50 years down the line.
Right, right. Thanks for the call, Greg. Yeah, I take the point. Exactly. Now, it's a little bit different if you're dressing up in blackface and a Klan outfit in 1984.
And who was the person next to the governor in that picture? It looked like a woman. Did you see the hands? Looked like because he was on a date.
Well,
you want to go dress up as a Klan?
He said he's neither person.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, sure. And I believe him for not a second.
And the yearbook editor said people submitted pictures for their own pages.
Right. They put the pictures in an envelope and handed them to the editor.
Right. So there is an issue there to be discussed. There's no question. I mean, again, the Klan thing.
Klan. I'm like.
Is
Gosh.
So far out of bounds, you can see why people are calling for him to disappear. John in Palatine.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I've been thinking about it, and we've got a couple of issues here with this governor, and people are calling for his resignation, and I strongly agree. But regarding the blackface, I think that would just show that he has no brains. I don't think he should resign for that. Now, talking about killing a delivered baby, I think that would just mean he doesn't have any heart. The reason why I think he should resign is because he said he did it. Everybody's kind of glossing over that part. He said he did it, and now he's saying he didn't do it, and that would show he has no character.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it should be.
Thanks for the call, John. Here's another case. The state rep out of Florida, did you see this one?
Oh.
Anthony Sabatini. Is not acceding to demands for him to resign as a state legislator. He's being accused by the Democrats in Florida of displaying racist behavior. A photo of him as a teen wearing dark makeup, sunglasses, and New York Yankees cap. This is a situation where he dressed up as his black friend.
Oh, right.
And his black friend dressed up as him. So his black friend wore, like, whatever, you know, like the polo shirt and whatever, like, you know, caricature of some white suburban kid. And he dressed up like how his friend dresses. He said Sabatini, I'm 16 years old. One of my best friends at the time was black. And we thought at the time, looking back, it was immature. It'd be funny to dress as each other. So he dressed in my clothes, Ralph Lauren polo shirt, shorts, Converse, and I dressed in his clothing. None of us thought 14 years later any of us would be a public figure and the photo would be decontextualized. So should Sabatini resign?
No.
In that context?
No.
Ed in Oak Brook. Hello, Ed. Ed in Oak Brook.
Hello. Going once.
Ed in Oak Brook.
Bye-bye, Ed.
Bill in the Northwest Side.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Good morning. I wanted to remind you that many years ago when one of the stars of the TV show Cheers,
yes,
Ted Danson, attended a roast in honor of his girlfriend, Whoopi Goldberg. He appeared in blackface as he stood right next to her. And nobody said a word about it. And the irony is that Whoopi Goldberg, of course, is one of the guest chairpersons on the show, The View, which Megyn Kelly got burned on for wearing blackface. But when Ted Danson did it for Whoopi Goldberg's roast, not a word was spoken, not one word. And he was at the pinnacle of his career, and it just went totally unmentioned.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Bill. Well, if you're dating Whoopi Goldberg, then you're exempt. God, Ted Danson dating Whoopi Goldberg.
I know. I'm still trying to process that. That was weird.
And by the way, to Bill's point, that was in the 80s. It wasn't that long ago. Coleman Hughes's point, again, this piece in National Review, it's good. This guy's I think he's still an undergrad at one of the Ivy League schools. This guy's really sharp. He writes that we should consider the idea that blackface need not be considered radioactive for all time. Such was the position taken by Bayard Rustin, Martin Luther King Jr.'s strategist and chief organizer of the March on Washington. In 1951, referring to blackface, Rustin wrote, "I think the time will come in the future when the Negro will be accepted into the social, economic, and political life of our country, when it will no longer be dangerous to do the sort of thing, and then, of course, we would not be opposed to minstrels per se." Coleman Hughes goes on to write, "Rustin recognized the deep hurt that minstrelsy caused in his day, but he did not see it as an eternal reality. He hoped that attitudes toward blackface would evolve over the time in the same way that attitudes toward Irish jokes have evolved." He wrote, "In certain parts in New York City 75 years ago, anyone would have been beaten up on the street if he told an Irish joke, because at the time the Irish in New York were considered an undesirable minority and were struggling for a kind of equality. Today, however, because the Irish are now accepted and integrated, Irish jokes are told freely, with the Irish themselves laughing quite as much as anyone else." And by the way, I mean, as he points out, Bayard Rustin was a chief strategist for Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. He knows a little bit about what he speaks when it comes to racial oppression. He was arrested 23 times on account of his activism. So he probably understood racism more viscerally than anybody walking around today who wasn't a part of the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. But I thought that's just an interesting point and an interesting perspective from someone who has the standing to offer it, Bayard Rustin's perspective and the integration perspective. Once you're accepted and you're part of society, then, you know, it's okay to bust each other's chops, as it were. And isn't that where we want to get to, where nobody is above reproach, nobody is above good-natured ridicule? You can tell an Irish joke, as he points out, and you would be able to, you know, have a little fun at people's expense, regardless of their race, ethnic heritage, and all the other things, just like you can with the Irish or the Italians today, because the immigrants that were undesirable 100 years ago are fully integrated, positions of a power, and all that in America and society. It's just a different way to kind of think about this and maybe talk about it.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Okay, Cubs fans, the Joe Ricketts email controversy, website called splinternews.com got hold of some of Joe Ricketts' emails. Joe Ricketts, of course, the patriarch of the Ricketts family that owns the Cubs, TD Ameritrade, the company that he started, which made him and his family very wealthy and able to purchase the Cubs.
Yes, they're billionaires.
And this is after another website. Was it the same? I can't remember now. But got a hold of some of Todd Ricketts's, one of Joe's sons, emails and published those previously. I mean, they were rather innocuous, mostly about Cubs business during the controversy they were having with City Hall as opposed for with respect to the improvements they wanted to do around the stadium and the Wrigleyville neighborhood and the resistance they were getting from Tiny Dancer and Alderman Tunney, who was famously resides up the butts of the Ricketts's. These with Joe are a little bit more incendiary, to say the least. They include really a lot of emails that were sent to him.
That were sent to Joe?
Right, okay. From a family friend that are fairly hard line when it comes to Muslims. Although it's interesting to note, in one of the email exchanges, Joe replies back to his family friend in this discussion about the threat of radical Islam, effectively. And that's really what they're talking about generally. But he replies, you know, I fund a school, a Muslim school in Uganda. I help finance it. Joe does.
Yeah.
And he said, I like to do it because one of the things I want to do is show them, Muslims, that we're not bad people. So, you know, the caricature that is being created of Joe Ricketts because of some of the anti-Obama sentiments and admittedly some of the conspiracy theories that are in some of these email exchanges is just that, a caricature, not exactly a complete picture of the man. Now, of course, the Cubs have rallied to the mob to apologize and try and put this behind them.
What are they apologizing for?
Well, they're apologizing. I mean, Joe, it started with Joe. Joe said in a statement, I deeply regret and apologize for some of the exchanges I had in my emails. Sometimes I received emails that I should have condemned. Other times I've said things that don't reflect my value system. I strongly believe that bigoted ideas are wrong. His son, Tom, released a statement on behalf of the Cubs organization. We're aware of the racially insensitive emails in my father's account that were published by an online media outlet. Let me be clear. The language and views expressed in those emails have no place in our society. My father is not involved with the operation of the Chicago Cubs in any way. I'm trusted with representing the organization and our fans with respect for people of all backgrounds. These emails do not reflect the culture we've worked so hard to build at the Chicago Cubs since 2009. And then because you can't let this go and you can't let a crisis remove the opportunity, Tiny Dancer weighed in.
Oh, boy.
Listen to this. This is this just pushes me to rally for Joe Ricketts and the Ricketts family. Joe Ricketts should consider himself lucky. He has never met my mother. She would teach him a lesson. I am proud not to share his bigoted opinions. Hate has no home in Chicago.
Here we go again.
Hate is very comfortable in Chicago, and it's mainly practiced by the cultural Marxist left, of which Tiny Dancer is an acolyte, is a fan, is an accomplice. So,
well, I'm reading some of these emails. I mean, Joe Ricketts wrote an email to SV once saying, you know, due to the radical aspect of Islam, we cannot let Iran have the nuclear bomb. We must destroy this ability with whatever we have to do. Christians and Jews can have a mutual respect for each other to create a civil society. As you know, Islam cannot do that. Therefore, we cannot let Islam become a larger part of our society. Muslims are naturally our enemy due to their deep antagonism and bias against non-Muslims. The old conform or die, which a lot of Christians and some Jewish people think of when they hear about Islam.
Yes, that's one of the more uncontroversial emails.
Okay.
There are others that go to the question of Barack Obama's religion. There are others that, you know, just jokes and as I said, conspiracy theories about Muslims in particular. Are there emails that are, you know, that don't put Joe Ricketts in the best light? Yes, there are.
Okay. Do you find these offensive?
I'm not looking to be offended because I'm a tolerant person. The intolerant are the ones looking to be offended. I'm not rushing to figure out ways to hold other people in ill repute. That's what the cultural Marxists do as a means to power and by subjugating people, by making them cower before the mob. So it's not about me being offended. It's me saying, are these some of these intemperate and ignorant? Yeah, they are. They are. But
he was contrite. One other email yesterday, I was quite hard on Muslims in our conversation, so I wanted to send you this information.
Right.
I have a private charity that he started, to help Muslim schools in Africa. So.
But then there's other off-color jokes of a racial nature. There's, as I said, it's a lot of, there's some conspiracy theories, including about President Obama. And so, again, does it put a captain of industry like Joe Ricketts in the best light? It doesn't. But what punishment should be meted out? What walk of shame must Joe Ricketts do? Well, Steve Greenberg writing in the Sun-Times. Yeah, it still publishes. I didn't know either.
The who? No, I'm kidding.
Cubs patriarch Joe Ricketts, his apology of no use has been starkly revealed. He said, Joe's more than just the, let me just read what Greenberg wrote. But old Joe is more than just the bumbling, embarrassing uncle or grandpa at Thanksgiving. He's the money behind the whole operation. He's the driver of the family clown car. Huh. The Ricketts family's clowns, according to Steve Greenberg. Until and unless that ceases, his gilded offspring should be questioned every turn about what steps they are taking to make Cub Dome a brighter, better place for all. What about it, Cubs fans? Are you going to boycott the Cubs this year? Or are you going to break out the torches and pitchforks for Joe Ricketts, like the Chicago Press Corps and the other cultural Marxist mobsters would have you do?
Reading these, this just feels, this is not my business. This is nobody's business.
Well, the whole issue
this whole thing is just...
Yeah, the whole issue of hacking other people's personal emails and then publishing them is an important additional topic, because certainly it's problematic when WikiLeaks does it with respect to Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. So some of these outlets that find no ethical problem with publishing hacked emails, that's a whole nother conversation about media in the 21st century. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. I think Rambo has a lot of nerve talking about his ma that way and against Joe Ricketts. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, his father fought with the Irgun, with Menachem Begin in Israel to basically make Israel a state way back when. So, how is that not bad when Schmeckelfinger, his family's involved in what many lefties consider terrorism in any case?
Well, lefties do, yeah. Thanks for the call, Greg.
I would hate for him to meet my mother.
What
year is this?
My
dad will beat up your dad in the back of the school parking lot.
Are you surprised to hear that from...
Tiny Dancer.
Are you surprised to hear that from, the tough-talking little guy?
The little midget? He's just a little guy.
You know what bullies are. They're cowards. You surprised to hear that the apron strings haven't been cut? Come on. Tom in Deer Park.
That's pretty funny. Notwithstanding, coming from Tiny Dancer, who called on the Christian Chick-fil-A that doesn't have Chicago values, and he never got called into account on that one, did he?
No,
but,
no
that's right.
But they I guess the bigger question, and you touched on it, as unseemly as some of this stuff is a cranky old man, a product of his generation, blah, blah, blah. Seems to me a person's emails are private property.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious as how these emails got released, purloined, or stolen. And again, as you touched on, how is it that people think that they can make these emails public and then comment on them? Seems to me like a Fourth Amendment issue, Dan. I wonder if you could touch on that.
Well, thanks for the call, Tom. I mean, I don't know about it. It's a Fourth Amendment. It's not government action here. It's a private actor. So it's somebody who broke the law by hacking. I don't think Joe Ricketts turned over these emails to Splinter News.
No.
So somebody hacked his emails or otherwise appropriated his property. And so that is criminal activity. And so, yes, if you could identify the responsible party, they should be brought to justice, no question. Candace in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I agree. If I were the Ricketts, I'd hire somebody because they're being targeted. This is just the beginning. So they need to get better servers. They need to get better, security. But they also need to do like a whole security analysis around them now because they're being targeted by the DNC, and this is just the beginning. And everybody who's GOP contributor out there should take note.
Thanks, Candace. I mean, here's the thing, too. What Candace points out, don't forget, Todd Ricketts now is the RNC finance chair.
Right.
So don't think that doesn't factor into this. Yeah. It absolutely does. It's a fair point that she makes. Here's the other question, though. If somebody goes after your dad, and I understand, hey, look, for all I know, Joe Ricketts told Tom, you know what, throw me under the bus. I'll apologize. Throw me under the bus. Don't worry about it. For the good of the organization, go ahead and, distance the organization from me. I don't have any day-to-day, oversight of operations. It's not reflective of Cubs values and all that stuff. The organization's more important. What we've got is more important, so don't worry about me. I wouldn't be surprised if that was said. I have no idea. But, I mean, at some point, is there going to be anybody who, in a position like this, who channels Howard Rourke? I've asked this before. Who's willing to stand against the whole world when the whole world is wrong? Is there anybody that say, you know what? Yeah, there's some emails that are problematic. There's some emails that my dad should have condemned, even though he just was a passive recipient. There's some things my dad said that I don't agree with. But you know what? Go yourself. My dad has contributed so much to this nation and this city by being a successful entrepreneur, by underwriting the purchase of the Cubs and what we've done with that neighborhood for the benefit of the city.
They've raised our property values because it's so beautiful what they've done. It's just stunning.
Right. And you know how we know we're serving the city? Because of all the people that are at every game and in the little neighborhood that we've built from ground up.
People are there all the time. They're ice skating. They've got, there's bars and restaurants, new ones that are open. It's a movie theater.
So hold me to account for things that I say or my dad says that are intemperate or wrong, factually, morally. But let's put this in a broader context, too. You're not going to marginalize my dad as some kind of bad person, as some kind of bigot, because of some of the things that he said that he has expressed regret for as well, in the context of all of the other things that he's done philanthropically and otherwise. I'd like to see a little bit more pushback against the mob. And I'm just wondering if we're ever going to see it from anybody who's targeted, particularly when they're in a position where they really can push back. Now, some would say, well, they've got so much at stake. They've got so much to risk. They can't. Somebody like, a goofball talking on the radio like Proft, who's got nothing to lose, he can do that. But we can't. I don't know. I don't know about that. There's going to be a moment where, because the other side is so unchastened, no matter how many casualties they inflict among their own, so unchastened by their overreach and their totalitarian instincts, there's going to be a moment where somebody or buddies are going to have to stand and deliver, or the whole thing is going to be steamrolled.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity. This afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5, on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy updating two cases. First, Jussie Smollett, the Empire star, the victim of that alleged attack a couple of weeks ago. Or probably not even a couple of weeks ago. It just seems like a couple of weeks, I guess. Rafer Weigall over at Fox Chicago reporting yesterday that Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson says Smollett is still being treated as the victim in the case, but he would be held accountable if the investigation reveals he made a false police report.
I got to tell you, kudos to Rafer Weigall, Tim Weigel's son.
He's been on it. Yeah,
he has been on it. He's the one that reported that despite all that happened, there's surveillance video of him walking into his apartment after the attack with his Subway sandwich still intact. Now, who gets attacked? And I'm like, oh, wait, I got to go get that Subway sandwich.
There's additional reporting that police were preparing for possible interrogations, but did not say of whom. Also, investigators working to identify the source of the rope that Smollett said was tied around his neck in a noose-like fashion during the attack. You know, the FBI can trace the rope, you know, the nature of the rope to points of sale. And so investigators apparently trying to identify the both the manufacturer and perhaps the retailer of the rope and obtain any video that may indicate who purchased said rope. So we'll see. We'll see on the Smollett case. But there's another possible false police report case, and this is against Alderman Proco, don't call me Gropo, Joe Moreno. Scum bag, this guy. Human garbage, this guy. Before we even get to the latest case, let me walk you down memory lane, not just working with Tiny Dancer to try and keep Chick-fil-A out of Chicago because Chick-fil-A doesn't represent Chicago values.
Oh my God.
Proco Joe Moreno was echoing that sentiment. Also, this story, shaking down the owner of the building that used to house Doubledore, that used to rent to the Doubledore nightclub music joint, after Doubledore was evicted by that building owner for failure to pay rent. This was reported on. We discussed it at the time. We brought in the watchdog organization that was investigating this case. And subsequently, there's been a federal civil suit filed against Proco Joe by the building owner. But just to, again, to give you a sense of who we're talking about and the feudal system under which Chicago operates.
Threatened by a Chicago alderman. A businessman says it happened to him. Their argument was caught on cell phone video, and what the alderman said is raising questions about his power and whether he went too far. To investigator Dave Savini reports.
Right now, I don't trust you. I don't trust your word. I don't think you're a man.
Strong words from a Chicago alderman to a property owner in his ward. That's First Ward Alderman Proco Joe Moreno with Brian Strauss, owner of this building, at the corner of Milwaukee and Damon, which housed historic music venue Doubledore for two decades, until Strauss evicted them in February.
Yeah, right off the bat, he's screaming obscenities.
Strauss said this video was taken the day of the eviction. The alderman knew he was being recorded.
I am upset. This is a tragedy.
It's part of life.
Right, and part of life is also that you're not going to have a tenant in here for 3 years.
The fight reportedly stems from Moreno wanting to keep the Doubledore, a campaign donor, in this building.
I felt that he was intimidating me, and that that he was threatening me.
Strauss said the alderman even tried to convince him at a city hall meeting to sell the building to Doubledore for millions less than it's worth. Strauss said no.
You are not going to get a dime out of this building.
While Strauss fought in court to vacate Doubledore's lease, Moreno introduced this city ordinance to change the building zoning, called downzoning, restricting the type of commercial and residential renters he can sign.
When the leases are up there, since there's a downzoning, you can't sign new leases for your tenants. It's going to be an empty building with no income for you or your family. End of conversation.
How about that? How about that?
He's flexing his muscles.
It's a little bit more than that. That's thugocracy. That is so. That's illegal, by the way. And he's got Proko Joe Moreno on video, audio, telling you that if you don't do what I say at the price point I determine for my campaign donor, the Double Door proprietors, I'm ending your property. I'm eliminating the market value of your property, or certainly greatly diminishing it. That's called extortion. That's a crime. And yet, Proko Joe Moreno, still walking around.
He thinks he's above the law.
Creating other, or committing other possible crimes. He reported his car stolen a month ago. CBS2, Dana Kozlov reporting.
Can Rob, first Ward Alderman Proko Joe Moreno first reported his 2016 Audi stolen a month ago. Chicago police confirm a woman was spotted driving it Sunday and is now facing charges, but not for a stolen vehicle. Alderman Moreno confirmed this is the woman cited for having his car. Chicago police say 35-year-old Lilia Rabar was charged with criminal trespass to the Audi after she was seen driving it yesterday, a misdemeanor, a month after he reported it stolen. The Alderman told police his car was taken from the 1300 block of North Levitt January 4th. It's not clear where police spotted his car Sunday when they sighted Rabar. I asked the alderman tonight what happened. He chalked it all up to a misunderstanding.
The car is not crashed. The car is in perfect condition. She's a friend of mine that we dated for a while. She's a single mom. I was trying to help out. She was down on her luck and needed a car. That's end of conversation. It's political season, and I get it. You throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. This is something that is absolutely 100% false.
Okay, and you weren't trying to falsify a police report?
Absolutely not. I did exactly what I was supposed to do.
No, what he was trying to do was in calling.
Rabar is now facing that misdemeanor. A police department spokesperson tonight says she was charged with criminal trespass to a vehicle instead of auto theft, a felony, because police can't prove she was the one who initially took the car, only that she was in it without permission when they found it.
What it's called? It's called insurance fraud. You give somebody something, they're like, well, I need a car, so I'll say it got stolen, so my insurance company can replace my vehicle.
If he filed an insurance claim, we don't know that. But here's what we do know. By the way, did you notice? End of conversation.
Yeah, he's a big bully.
That's the same thing he said to the building owner he was extorting. Yeah. End of conversation. This conversation's over.
No, this conversation is not over.
Here's the thing. If he filed a police report, saying it was stolen, then he says to Dana Kozlov, she's a friend, dated for a while, she's a single mom, down on her luck, I was trying to help her. Well, if you were trying to help her, that means you gave her your car.
Right, and this is the thing. So Channel 9 has text messages between this woman, Lily, and Proko Joe. When and where do you want to pick it up? This is Proko Joe. I can come now to where you are. Meet me at my house at 11, you can have my car. Can you get me an Uber, please, at 10:30 to bring me to your house? Thanks so much. Yes, just tell me when you're ready. And then there were some more text messages, and he says, don't smoke in my car. And then she says, baby, I'm with, and something redacted because it's gross.
And do we have the time date stamps on these?
We don't, but this is before he gave her car a month ago.
But this is proximate, I mean, to when he reports the car stolen.
Cool. Can we have dinner tomorrow? Yes, please. And then there's some gross emoji. And then here it is. They're talking back, and I don't know what this timestamp says. Hi, hope you're feeling well. And then she sends a picture of her, a selfie, where she's scantily dressed. How is your day, baby? And he said, better now. You look fantastic. Just need to get through this election, and then I want you.
That's great banter.
Hey, baby, glad you're good. And then, ready for this? Right before, I need my car back ASAP. It's my car. Tell them to call me ASAP, and I'll explain all of this.
Okay.
She says to him, I got pulled over by police. They reported that your car was stolen.
What happened to the hey baby?
Is this not your car? Will you give me the sorry, I can't read that. You know I got in huge trouble. Please call them and get my stuff back from what was inside the car. And then he said, I need my car back ASAP. And that was the end of their text messaging. So she knows that she's backed into a corner and she's fighting. Because he gave her this car, and then she gets pulled over by police on Sunday.
So she...
He's got to go to jail.
She ostensibly shouldn't be charged with a crime.
No,
and
not at all.
When Moreno says, this is political, I don't know how it's political, and he says, I did exactly what I was supposed to do. You reported a car stolen that you voluntarily gave some girl you were dating. That's not doing what you were supposed to do.
That's filing a false police report.
That's a crime.
Yep, that's a crime.
So can somebody explain to me why Proko Joe hasn't been arrested yet? I mean, for anything. Extorting a private property owner in his ward, filing a false police report, general thuggery.
Promising if you go out to dinner with him, he'll help your son get into a selective enrollment high school.
Well, that's not a crime. That's just being unseemly.
No, that's not a crime, but that's just, well, it speaks to his character. I mean, he thinks he can grab any woman anywhere he wants and do whatever he wants. Well, you know what? Time's up.
Well, he's a smooth talker. You heard the hey, baby.
Oh my God.
Hey, baby, I want you.
After this election stuff's over, I'm going to come and get you. Exclamation point emoji that's inappropriate to describe over the air.
I mean, we're only flesh and blood. Who can resist the Shakespearean overtures of one Proko Joe Moreno?
And have you seen this single mom, this Lily Harbor or Haber?
I saw the photo that was posted.
Yeah, she's good looking.
She can do better. I hope she knows that now. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. I find it interesting that for quid pro quo Joe Moreno, that for the left especially, evidence of current corruption is way, way less important. In fact, insignificant compared to, say, oh, I don't know, like 40-year-old Halloween pictures. You know, I think once I dressed up in third or fourth grade as Zorro, so I'm wondering if somebody has a picture of that. Gosh, I don't know who I've offended. Probably Zorro is bad now.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Mike on the north side.
Hey, good morning. I'm more upset at the Scum Times for endorsing this guy and these so-called prosecutors. Lisa Madigan, Kwame Raoul, Crimeisha Fox. How come they never went after this guy when he tried extorting a building? Public corruption. They did nothing. They let this guy operate. They condoned it. Well, and Amy, I never told you this before, but I'm proud of you for not selling out to the machine to help your kid out.
Just
remember, while your kid is working hard, putting himself through college and that, these other kids, they're the ones that are taken away in an ambulance from Lollapalooza for ODing because they weren't raised right.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it was a hard decision to make. It was really awful. I'm not going to sugarcoat this at all. Because you want to help your kid and you want to do what you can so that they can get into a high school where they could succeed. Because we have such a messed up system in Chicago and I didn't do it. And I mean, I just didn't do it. I couldn't do it. And my son knows because I talked to him about it. And he's doing well at Amundsen and he loves it there and he's getting straight A's. So I'm sorry.
Well, as Mike said, you did the right thing. And this is exactly what political thugs do to people. Piece of human garbage, Proko Joe Moreno, and all those politicians you love in Chicago that you and your friends support, not you listening to this show mainly, but your friends support, the Kim Foxes that let this go on, all the high-minded journalists at the Sun-Times and elsewhere that flack for the thugs like Proko Joe Moreno. Remember this.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, good morning. Just following up on our story from end of last hour, I guess Proko Joe Moreno, a.k.a. Gropo Joe Moreno, the alderman, being investigated, filing a false police report, I guess he needed his car back because it was his turn to carpool Danny Solis and friends to the massage parlor.
Hey, yo. Oh, and by the way, his girlfriend or friend with benefits, she spent the night in jail, okay? And he's not in jail right now. I mean, this is, we're going to, of course, stay on top of this story and try to find her, but he sent the text messages that we read. He texted her, and the next day he filed a police report saying it was missing.
You know, at some point when Proko Joe Moreno can get away with extorting private property owners and filing false police reports, at some point, I don't know what it's going to be. At some point, you're going to have a yellow vest action in Chicago. At some point when enough people realize there is no justice to be had for people that are not connected to the feudal lords in this city. Something is going to happen that sparks a revolt. I don't know what it is. I wish I did, because other, right now it's just a bolt, people just leaving. Oh, and they're leaving New York, too. Andrew Cuomo just found out when he looked at the state's income tax receipts and found them about $2.3 billion off. Then he took to the airwaves to blame Trump.
SALT was an economic civil war. It literally restructured the economy to help red states at the cost of blue states. That's exactly what it did. It was a diabolical political maneuver in the tax code that actually raised taxes on Democratic states, lowered taxes on Republican states, and financed the Republican state tax cut from the Democratic states.
Yeah, it was diabolical. So the high tax states are feeling the brunt of their high taxes, and low tax states are enjoying a residual benefit for being low tax state. And that's the choice that every state is making. But Andrew Cuomo doesn't like it, so much so that he's saying, God forbid the rich leave as they are. Wow. It's nice to see even some 60-year-old hack politician who, as I said before, wouldn't be a bathroom attendant in a monkey park without his last name.
That's true. And his brother wouldn't have the job he has without his last name.
It's nice to see even he can learn an Econ 101 lesson. For other lessons of this sort, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist and chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. Good morning. By the way, I learn a lot listening to the Dan and Amy show. I had not heard that quote from Governor Cuomo.
Yeah.
I feel very vindicated, by the way. You know, I was the one who, when we were doing all the tax negotiations and there was talk about maybe we should restore the state and local tax deduction, I said, oh, hell no, we're not going to do that. I mean, there is no reason. And I know, you know, some of my friends in Illinois, and I'm not going to like to hear this because you're a really high tax state, too. But there is no justification for why someone living in Florida or Texas or Tennessee should have to pay higher federal taxes to subsidize the bloated pensions and government services in places like New York and California and New Jersey and Connecticut and Illinois. It just isn't there. And, you know, now, by the way, liberals love to talk about how taxes don't matter. I mean, Alexandria Cortez said, we can raise taxes to 70% and it won't change people's behavior. Well, look, you look at what's happened when we've capped the state and local tax deduction. Cuomo's right. People are moving from high tax states to low tax states. This is what Art Laffer and I predicted a year ago in the Wall Street Journal. You can look it up. We predicted this migration would happen. Now, one final thought. There's a very easy way for Illinois and California and Connecticut and New Jersey and states like that, these Democratic states, to bring people back. Cut your taxes.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
I know. It would never happen, right? I mean, cut taxes in Illinois?
I don't know.
I mean, now you've got this dumb policy. What's the latest on this idea of getting rid of the flat tax in Illinois so they can raise taxes more on rich people?
Well, right. I mean, that's your idea is just crazy enough to work. But listen to this in Illinois, since for those who don't know, have not remembered, Steve Moore hails from Illinois, new Trier grad, University of Illinois grad. So he has the standing to comment on this as a denizen in addition to as an economist. Here's what Illinois is, Steve. Illinois is the state where the pro-business group is anti-business and pro-tax increase, is anti-growth.
Well, which group is this?
The Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago this week called for increasing the state's individual income tax rate from 4.95 to 5.95. Its corporate tax rate from 7 to 8, and also starting to tax both retirement income and some consumer services.
Are you serious?
Serious. Serious. That would destroy the state.
I mean, we've talked about it on the show. You're already losing residents to, West Virginia and Kentucky. I mean, my gosh, you would see, right now, by the way, I am in beautiful West Palm Beach, Florida, and everywhere I go, I see Illinois license plates.
Oh, yeah.
People are moving out, and you know what they do? A lot of them still have places in Illinois. They just live in Illinois 180 days of the year, and they live in states like, Florida for 190 days of the year, and therefore they're Florida residents. They don't have to pay that 7 or 8% income tax that the Civic Foundation thinks it would be so wonderful. You're going to lose revenue if you do that. You're going to lose your people. You're going to lose your businesses. I mean, how hard is this for these people to figure out?
Well, here's the thing, too. I just want to punctuate it with this for people who've never heard of the Civic Committee, the Commercial Club of Chicago. These are people that you talk to on a regular basis. These are C-suite Fortune 100 executives that are calling for this.
What can I say? I mean, that will hurt small businesses. It will hurt jobs. I mean, we did a study out, Laffer and I, last year. We estimated every single day in America and twice on Sunday, 1,000 people on net are leaving the 10 highest tax states. And yes, Illinois is one of the 10 highest tax states, or one of the 5 highest tax states. And they're moving to Texas and Florida and, Nevada and Tennessee and North Carolina and Georgia and states with low taxes. I mean, how hard is this for people to figure out? I mean, it's happening right before our very eyes. And why? One of the reasons I love that quote that you started this segment with by Cuomo is he's telling the truth. Yes, people are leaving New York, and they're leaving New York to escape the high taxes. Why is that so hard for him to figure out?
Well, speaking of taxes, is there going to be a second round of tax cuts for us coming soon via President Trump?
With Speaker Pelosi? You think that's going to happen, Amy?
Well,
I mean, look, I'd love to see it happen. Yeah, I mean, look, they're not going to, they want to raise taxes. Don't you get it? I mean, I'm not just talking to you. I'm talking to the liberals. The Democrats want to raise taxes. I mean, the new darling of the Democratic Party is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She wants to raise taxes to 70%. By the way, I saw another Democrat said, that's not enough. We've got to go to 80 to 90% tax rates. And then we've got Elizabeth Warren. She wants a wealth tax. And then this other person wants the highest, carbon tax in the world, which is just a tax on your energy use and your gasoline. I mean, Dan, you said you talked about the yellow vests. I do think the yellow vests are coming in this country. People are sick of it. Why aren't there yellow vests yet in the streets of Chicago, revolting against this revolting government?
Mark Hemingway, speaking of Speaker Pelosi, Mark Hemingway, formerly of the Weekly Standard, he tweeted out this. I mean, I'm not surprised, but some part of me can't believe we're at a place where the President of the United States said, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country, and the Democratic Speaker of the House deliberately did not applaud. It is sort of remarkable, this moment we find ourselves in, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, look, folks, I mean, this is not your parents' Democratic Party any longer. And by the way, I'm not a rah-rah Republican. You guys have known me for a long time. I'm happy to criticize Republicans. But, you know, the craziness, I just wrote a column on the Green New Deal. Alicia Cortez just came out with a new, this is their new manifesto. And by the way, it's to the left of the Communist Manifesto. I mean, they want to, it's basically free health care for everyone. Everyone gets a guaranteed job at least a $15 minimum wage. We're going to eliminate all fossil fuel jobs in fossil fuel production in America. Let's see, that's going to probably cost us about 15 million jobs. It's probably going to double your electricity bills. We're going to have $5 and $6 gallon gasoline, but we have to do this to genuflect to the gods of climate change. I mean, there is a craziness and a rabid lunacy on the left, and so I'm waiting for someone. Where is the adult in the room? On the Democratic side of the aisle, where are the Bill Bradleys and the Sam Nunns and the Dick Gephardts to say this is craziness? The only one I've heard is this guy, Howard Schultz, the Starbucks CEO, who I don't agree with him a lot of things, but he's the first one to say this is crazy.
Yep, he stood up to him.
On the border wall funding, interesting, yesterday the House Majority Whip, Democrat, of course, James Clyburn, saying, he'd be open to a border wall if it's demonstrated that if experts say it would work. Other Democrats.
Now, who are you talking about?
James Clyburn, the House Majority Whip, said that.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's my solution to this, by the way. I think because both parties are in a corner right now. We don't want another government shutdown. That'd be stupid. And I don't think Trump would be wise to do this through executive order unless he absolutely has to. So why not do that? Appropriate the money for the border security and let the, quote, experts, the customs and border officials who know the border, decide the best way to use that money. I think that would be a good, don't you? I mean, I think that would be a good solution to this, and you wouldn't have to shut down the government. You'd get, look,
that's
I'm
pro-immigration.
I love Trump yesterday saying we need more immigrants. Yeah. We do need more immigrants. They have to come in legally, and it ain't going to happen until we get that border secure.
Well, I like that idea because, I mean, it's just a backdoor way to get to the same place because, as President Trump said when he proposed his compromise a couple weeks ago, what I'm proposing is based on the input from those same experts. So if you want to just give them the money and say wherever you think it should be spent, that's let's spend it, fine, because we already know where it's going to be spent.
So, Dan, you and I and Amy just solved the border problem.
All right, yes, well, let's end on a high note.
Yeah,
he is Steve Moore.
They have us running the government.
Well,
no, but that's exactly the solution. Everybody goes away happy, and then we can move on to fixing our legal immigration system and get, as Larry Kudlow calls them, the brainiacs into this country so we can grow.
There you go. Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist, CNN. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, take care, guys.
Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Woo-hoo. Oh, mm-hmm.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money?
Yeah, sing it.
He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Indeed, our latest in our moving out segment. By the way, mentioned the Civic Committee, the Commercial Club, supporting tax increases at the state level. It's impossible to distinguish the business leaders in Chicago from the union bosses. Same day, coalition of progressive activists, big unions, proposing a LaSalle Street tax on financial transactions. Oh, yes. But also a 3.5% income tax for the city on household income above $100,000. There it is.
Bingo.
Also proposing to form a Chicago city-owned bank that would take over the task of investing pension monies and underwriting city bond issues. What could possibly go wrong with that?
Oh, nothing. I would trust that bank with all my money.
These guys are hysterical because you love being robbed. And they love doing it. Brandon Marshall is our house to discuss today. 6 North Michigan Avenue, Unit 1901. One-of-a-kind penthouse in the former Montgomery Ward Observatory. 6,000 square feet of living space over 4 floors. Brandon Marshall earned it. March 2014, Marshall paid $3.9
million
for the penthouse. That's $4.15 in today's dollars.
Yeah, how much did he sell?
He's a listing. He hadn't sold yet. He listed it for $4.98 in April of 2018. That's funny, Brandon. Come on.
Don't be greedy. Come on.
Money on your home here. You know better than that. Yeah. It's now lower to 3.9 on Tuesday. So if he can find somebody at 3.9, he will have lost only $250,000 for owning that penthouse for just over 4 years.
Oh, my gosh.
That's Illinois, and it's more of the same.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Kamala Harris hasn't had time to weigh in on the Virginia Minstrel Party or the allegations of sexual assault made against the sitting Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax because she's been too busy.
Doing what?
Castigating Naomi Rao, President Trump's nominee to fill the vacancy on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals left by Brett Kavanaugh's elevation to the Supreme Court over her writings about women protecting themselves from being put in a position where they are less safe than they could be. Listen to this exchange yesterday. We played Cory Booker's yesterday, right, of trying to dig into the religious beliefs of Naomi Rao. It's a constitutional violation, but it's Cory Booker and T-Bone, so we give him a break.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris on now interrogating Rao about her views on women and victims of sexual assault.
You said when having a conversation with Senator Ernst, you said, quote, women should take certain steps to avoid becoming a victim. What steps do you have in mind that women should take to avoid becoming a victim of sexual assault?
Senator, it's just sort of a common sense idea about, for instance, excessive drinking. You know, that was advice that was given to me by my mother.
So that's one step you believe women should take to avoid becoming a victim of sexual assault?
It is just a way to make it less likely. It's not to blame the victim. You know, rape and sexual assault are horrible crimes, but we're talking about what can you do to keep yourself safe.
Are there other steps that you believe women should take to avoid becoming a victim of sexual assault?
That is one of the issues that I discussed. I'm not sure if there are others.
So do you believe if a woman does not take those steps that she is at fault or partially at fault for what happens to her?
No.
So what is the significance of taking those steps?
Well, I think it's just the significance of trying to avoid becoming a victim of any crime, right? We take different steps to try to protect ourselves from horrible crimes such as rape. And, you know, and I think what we want is for women to not be victims.
Outrageous, isn't it? Naomi Rao's suggestion, have your faculties about you. Groundbreaking stuff. After that exchange, Kamala Harris tweeted this. Here's the bottom line. Survivors of sexual assault should not be blamed for the trauma they've experienced. Naomi Rao's prior writings about sexual assault are completely unacceptable, and her responses to my questions today were deeply troubling. You're a female. Did you hear anything deeply troubling about what Naomi Rao had to say?
No. It's sound advice that you receive when you start off in college and become of the drinking age. Keep your faculties about you, because then you have a less likely chance of being jumped in an alley or when you're walking down the street. Know your surroundings, because you should be sober.
Yeah. And
I'm not offended at all.
And don't go to a hotel room at the 2004 DNC convention in Boston with somebody who has aspirations to be the governor of Virginia. Other good advice moms should give their daughters. For more on this topic and others, we're pleased to be joined by Julie Kelly. She's a senior contributor for American Greatness, amgreatness.com. You can catch her writings there. Also, she is an Illinois denizen hailing from Orland Park. Julie, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How are you?
Good morning. So how have you enjoyed what Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, some of the great presidential aspirants the Democrats are providing us, what they've had to say over the last couple of days, both about the President's State of the Union address and with respect to Booker and Harris in the context of this confirmation hearing?
I mean, look, I think we're starting to get a view into the 2020 presidential election and what that is going to look like. And first of all, you're going to have a president with a strong message and a list of accomplishments and a vision for America versus this collection of Democrats, both congressional and presidential candidates, who are divided, who are deranged in some ways, and have no message for the American people that they care about. They don't really have a message about jobs. They don't have a message about security. They don't have a message about immigration except for open borders. And so I think we're starting to get a view of what next year is going to look like with this kind of clown collection on the Democratic side.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren yesterday, she was trying to walk or talk her way out of why she put down that she was an American Indian on her Texas bar form. Do you think, I know she hasn't officially announced she's supposed to this Saturday. Do you think maybe she should just sit this one out? Because really what she did was commit fraud, because she took a spot away from a real American Indian.
She's running against somebody who's got an imaginary friend. I mean, you know, what's the standard here?
Yeah, I mean, this is really shaping up to look better for Donald Trump if he does decide to run. He's got to be excited about this field of candidates. I understand, too, that there will be more documents released related to Elizabeth Warren and other times that she's claimed to be an American Indian to get an advantage over other people. Kamala Harris is an embarrassing person. I was shocked and really outraged at her comments at Naomi Rowe. I have two teenage daughters, one who just went off to college. I mean, this is advice I've given them for the last few years and, you know, repeat to her when she's at school. Kamala Harris is not a parent. She has no children. Cory Booker has no children. I mean, I'm thinking about writing this. You really have a field of candidates and Democratic leaders in Congress, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of her pals in the Democratic Congress. These people aren't parents, which doesn't really mean that you don't have, you know, you shouldn't have a say. But when Kamala Harris says something like that, it shows how out of touch she is with reality. And I think that that's something that Republicans need to point out every time that they say something so egregious like that.
Speaking of out of touch with reality, I thought one of the interesting moments of contrast yesterday's State of the Union speech was, or Tuesday night's State of the Union speech, was President Trump talking about the venomous poison of anti-Semitism, recognizing the Holocaust survivor, also the Tree of Life Synagogue survivor, the police officer who acted heroically during the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting. And then you've got among the would-be suffragettes, Congresswomen Tlaib and Omar, who have increasingly been revealed to hold quite anti-Semitic views, in addition to their you know, clique leader, Ocasio-Cortez, essentially suggesting that the state of Israel shouldn't exist. It's sort of a remarkable contrast. I don't know that it moves the needle among the Jewish vote, which is so locked in 70-30 with Democrats, but it certainly is an important message for, I would think, conservatives and Republicans to deliver on that important issue.
I agree. And every time that Representative Omar is confronted with the issue of Israel, she, you know, continues to dig a deeper hole. Some of the comments that she makes, I just watched a clip of her. She did a 2-minute video. She actually said that she felt sorry for the American heroes who attended the State of the Union address because they were being used by President Trump.
Oh my gosh.
Now, this is a woman who does not have any World War II veterans in her family, obviously. Yeah. So for someone like me who does, I find it just outrageous. And, you know, how can you be so arrogant to say that about people who attend the State of the Union address, who have devoted their lives to this country? And you have this young girl with no family lineage who's served in the military say that. So, I mean, this is... These people really, it's not just that they don't have any policy ideas. You really start to wonder about their allegiance to America.
What's your perspective on the importance of Trump finding some way to get the funding that he needs to advance physical border security interests on the southern border? Mick Mulvaney was on with Hannity last night. His acting chief of staff said, look, we've been looking for months now, and we've got in excess of $5.7 billion that we believe the president has the authority to deploy how he sees fit, which still sounds sort of like executive action, national emergency declaration, something the president is loath to do. But does he need to be willing to shut down the government again to get this done and move this flag for border security?
I don't think he should shut down the government again. I've written about this. I think he should employ the National Emergencies Act. It's well within his power and authority to use that to declare a national emergency. We have national emergencies that have been in place for 30 plus years. It's within his purview to do it. I wish he would have done it a few weeks ago when this issue was really at its apex. He really had public support, at least behind border security and even a wall. I think he lost an opportunity there. I don't think the government shutdown is a good idea. I think he declares a national emergency, gets this done, and then uses this against the Democrats next year, that they refuse to come to the table on anything related to border security and put them on the defensive on this issue, instead of continuing to give them more control over it.
Well,
he declares the emergency and moves on.
He's got the rally scheduled in El Paso on Monday, so that could be the opportunity to do it if he's going to do it.
Yeah, he'll be 1,000 yards away from the border.
He's going to have it at the El Paso Coliseum and in Beto O'Rourke's backyard. So that's good.
And I really personally would like to see him get this resolved and moved on. He really needs to start talking about the economy and some other issues, you know, talking about the deregulation and talking about these great economic numbers and contrasting that with the Democrats who really have no plan. So I know immigration is a compelling issue for a lot of his base, but I think that there are other serious accomplishments that he needs to keep talking about so he can expose the Democrats' lack of any serious agenda.
She is Julie Kelly. She is a senior contributor for American Greatness, amgreatness.com. Also an Orland Park resident for now, I presume. I got to add for now to any Illinois resident. Julie Kelly, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate
it. Thanks, guys.
Always a pleasure. Yep, and she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Needs a refill. I got a squad with a list of complainers. I should have started rape. Rappers against phony entertainers.
So we can make it known that we won't get swayed. It's 91, son, so something's got to change. Pop goes the weasel because the weasel goes pop. If only Virginia Democrats in the 80s would have become fans of third base and imitated third base for their dance competitions and their undergrad parties at UVA, they could have avoided all of this ugliness. But I guess if you have a racist heart, it eventually reveals itself. So we're down to fourth in line for the governor of Virginia. Now that yesterday we find the attorney general of the state of Virginia, a Democrat.
Yeah, third in line.
Who called on Ralph Northam to resign.
Yes, don't forget that fact, people.
Said, oh, yeah, by the way, 1980, when I was 19 years old, an undergrad at UVA, I wore blackface to imitate my rappers of the day, like Curtis Blow, my favorite rappers of the day, like Curtis Blow.
And he said that, you know, Curtis Blow, and we were going to perform a song. So the question actually is, which one were they going to perform?
Now basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way to dribble up and down the court. I like to see him perform that. I like no interruption when the game is on. I like slam dunk to take me to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like to pick and roll. I like to give and go. And it's basketball. Bow wow, let's go.
But then you suggested the break.
The breaks. Yeah, that's a good. That's a Curtis Blow song,
breaks.
Too.
It's a good one. Breaks in a bus, breaks on the car.
Breaks to make you a superstar. All right. Breaks to win. Here's what I suggest.
What do you suggest?
I will let Attorney General Mark Herring off the hook.
If?
And requalify him to succeed Ralph Northam if he can perform either one of those Curtis Blow songs.
Well, he said, though, this sounds ridiculous even now that I'm writing it, but because of our ignorance and glib attitudes and because we did not have an appreciation for the experiences and perspective of others, we dressed up and put on wigs and brown makeup. Drop mic. Boom.
All right. So he's got problems. And
but who's got worse problems?
Well, Justin Fairfax. He's the lieutenant governor. Mm-hmm. He was accused 15 years ago at the 2004 DNC convention in Boston when he was a staffer for John Kerry by Vanessa Tyson, who is now a professor at Scripps College, of sexual assault. The allegation that was made but not publicized during his run for lieutenant governor, the D.C. press corps decided not to report on it.
Yeah, Washington Post said they had this story a year ago. They properly tried to vet it and said it was a non-story, so they didn't publish it.
But different, interesting. Their standard Kavanaugh didn't seem to be the same. I'm sure neither was Justin Fairfax's. Now, Ms. Tyson has released a detailed statement through her counsel.
Yeah.
That provides graphic description of what she says happened on the night of July 28th, 2004.
Mr. Fairfax put his hand behind my neck and forcefully pushed my head towards his heathen region. Only then did I realize that he had unbuckled his belt, unzipped his pants, and taken out the penis. He then forced his penis into my mouth. Utterly shocked and terrified. Well, she said she tried to move her head away, but he could not because his hand was holding. I mean, it was awful. So she said, I consciously avoided Mr. Fairfax for the remainder of the convention, and I never spoke to him again, which is an exact opposite of what he said. He said that she called him after the convention and said she wanted to meet his mother and that she wanted to come and visit. Well, that's not what she says.
I can't believe, given my obvious distress, that Mr. Fairfax thought the forced sexual act was consensual. To be very clear, I did not want to engage in it. I never gave any form of consent. Quite the opposite. I consciously avoided Mr. Fairfax for the remainder of the convention. I never spoke to him again after the assault. I suffered from both deep humiliation and shame. I did not speak about it for years. And I, like most survivors, suppressed these memories and emotions as a necessary means to continue my studies, pursue my goal of building a successful career as an academic. At the time, I found the horrific incident especially degrading, given my regular volunteer work at a local rape crisis center. And it goes on. She follows his political career, or he bubbles to the surface when he's running for statewide office in Virginia. And so she makes this admission, or restates this allegation, as it were.
And the craziest thing is that she hired Kristen Blasey's Ford's attorney, and the lieutenant governor has hired Brett Kavanaugh's attorney.
Well, her recollection is very specific and specific with respect to Fairfax. And it's a one-on-one situation, according to both of them. It's just a matter of whether or not the event was consensual. That's very different than Blasey Ford's recollection at the house party. But regardless, yes, it's uncorroborated. But is it credible enough to prompt an investigation? What would Democrats say if that was a Republican lieutenant governor? Is that a credible enough allegation to prompt an investigation?
Yes.
To suggest that Mr. Fairfax even resign? Would there be calls if this was a Republican?
Yeah, she could still file. Was it 15 years ago? The statute of limitations is 15 years on this. So she said, you know, as of right now, she has not filed a complaint.
Tiana Lowe, writing in the Washington Examiner, finds Tyson's story credible. Further investigation could possibly fulfill the preponderance of evidence standard. Fairfax not doing himself any favors with NBC reporting that in a private meeting on Monday night, Fairfax said of Miss Tyson, F that B regarding her allegation. So maybe regardless of the veracity of the allegation, his temperament, temperament, wasn't that a word that was used against Kavanaugh? Maybe his temperament.
Well, he's not fit to hold office.
Yes, indeed.
And his moral standards, you know. What are his? And I wonder what Mrs. Fairfax thinks of all this.
We have not heard from Mrs. Fairfax.
No. I wonder if she'll be standing by her man.
What about, I think we know the answers, really rhetorical questions, the answers to how would the D.C. press corps be treating this if the target was a Republican? How would the political ruling class be treating this if this were a Republican? I think we know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. What about the answer to blackface? Blackface as a career-ending error in judgment, or worse, act of racism in some cases, it is. That's the Virginia Minstrel Party.
Yeah,
That's awful. What it calls to mind, overt racism. What about that? Is that disqualifying for holding office or for
being an entertainer? I mean, look, Jimmy Kimmel's done it. Jimmy Fallon's done it. Ted Danson. I mean, the list goes on and on of Robert Downey Jr., you know, in Tropic Thunder. He dressed up in blackface.
Yeah.
I mean, he did, essentially, in Soul Man.
See Thomas Howell.
So that far-leaning left, they can do it. Politicians can't.
Now, Ted Danson took heat for doing that at the Whoopi Goldberg Friars Club event. However,
because they were dating.
Yeah, but, well, yes. However, he went on to have a successful post-Cheers career. I mean, Becker and Curb Your Enthusiasm and other series and acting.
He's currently in a sitcom on NBC. I can't remember the name.
Yeah,
of it,
yeah, but right. The problem is the broad brush, no pun intended. So then you have Mary Poppins is racist now. We talked about yesterday because of the chimney sweep scene where they've got soot on their face. Or you have
a picture of coal miners at a bar
exactly
after work, and that's deemed as racist.
So
it's just depicting a moment in history.
So what's the standard with respect to how justice, cultural or professional or political, how justice is meted out in cases like this. That's what I'm, I guess I'm trying to get to. Take your calls on that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Amy's mentioned a bunch of examples of entertainers doing it. Fred Armisen impersonating Obama. Ashton Kutcher did brownface to depict a stereotypical Indian man in a Pop Chips commercial. There was a scene in the scene in one of the episodes of Always Sunny in Philadelphia where two actors did that. Two of the actors did that. So, you know, and it's a comedy. Coleman Hughes has a really good piece on this in nationalreview.com. Coleman Hughes, undergrad at Columbia. He writes for Colette normally. This is a really sharp young man. Very good writer. He has thought through this with great specificity, and he actually recalls Martin Luther King Jr.'s chief strategist and organizer of the March on Washington. His name was Bayard Rustin. In 1951, referring to blackface specifically, Bayard Rustin said, "I think the time will come in the future when the Negro will be accepted into the social, economic, and political life of our country, when it will no longer be dangerous to do this sort of thing, and then, of course, we would not be opposed to minstrels per se." He, Coleman Hughes writes, "Rustin recognized the deep hurt that minstrelsy caused in his day, but he did not see it as an eternal reality. He hoped that attitudes toward blackface would evolve over time in the same way that attitudes toward Irish jokes had evolved." He wrote, again, and this is 60 years ago, he wrote, "In certain parts of New York City, 75 years ago, anyone would have been beaten up on the street if he told an Irish joke, because at that time, the Irish in New York were considered an undesirable minority, were struggling for a kind of equality. Today, however, because the Irish are now accepted and integrated, Irish jokes are told freely with the Irish themselves laughing quite as much as anyone else." And I think it's a really interesting point that Bayard Rustin made at the time, a prescient point, but it's a different way to look at it. You know, if you're accepted and you feel comfortable, then when somebody, busts your chops, as it were, ridicule is probably even too strong a word, you laugh along with it because you know it's not coming from a place of hatred or subjugation. It's not intended to be demeaning. It's intended to be like we all laugh at ourselves, right? So you sit around with friends and you tell an Irish joke and somebody tells an Italian joke. Nobody really gets
upset.
Swedish
joke.
Yeah, whatever, right? Polish joke, whatever.
Swedes, we got it.
Pick one, right? But because some don't want to, I think some on the left don't want to ever see blacks the way Bayard Rustin predicted would happen when the Negro is, his words, when the Negro will be accepted into the social, economic, and political life of our country. There are those on the left that don't want that to happen, or at least to create the perception that it can't happen, won't happen, isn't happening, because there's power in that. There's no power if we all get along and black people feel as accepted into the social fabric as Irish or any other race or ethnicity that has not been treated as badly, admittedly, during the course of American history as black people have. But if they're accepted and we can all sit around and have a beer and laugh at each other, then there's no race hustling to be had and there's no power to be gained. It's such an interesting sociological point that Bayard Rustin made, and I'm so glad Coleman Hughes identified it and shared it, because that should be part of the conversation too if we're going to try and be intelligent about this, which I know is a challenge. Jim.
And real quick, I mean, Northam's picture seems so much worse to me than what the attorney general did, because he's standing next to a person dressed in a Klan outfit.
Well, that's not him, according to him. The fact that he has a picture, the fact that the new yearbook editor says we took submissions from the students, would be unusual that we just put that picture on his page without him providing it to us. So the fact that he provided a picture, even if it's not him, let's just stipulate. Yeah. Blackface and Klan, the Klan in particular. In 84, the Klan, murderers organization. That is
sick.
This is why I'm saying there's a difference between doing that and Jimmy Kimmel impersonating Karl Malone on a variety show. Yeah. That's not the same thing. This is like when we get into the Me Too stuff. You know, an off-color joke in an elevator is not the same thing as Harvey Weinstein pushing you against a wall. So let's understand where the gradations are and try and set some some guideposts, as it were. Jim in Willowbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Morning.
I just had one comment. It seems like no matter what people do to become more and more politically correct, the left is just going to set the bar higher and higher. They're always going to find something to be upset about. And it just, it seems like, I mean, these three guys, number two, I don't know. But the governor and the attorney general, this is stuff that happened when they were kids.
Well, 20,
are we going to start really?
25-year-old med student. That's not a
right.
kid. That's not a kid.
And for Marcus,
well,
he was 19.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. But the 19-year-old,
yeah.
I mean, he came out and got in front of it.
Yep.
He knows, are we going to really ruin everybody's reputations about something that in Virginia culture back in the 80s might have been acceptable?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jim. Well, here's the thing about the attorney general, why I have little sympathy for him, is because he threw in with the mob against Northam.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And now he wants the mob to leave him alone. Trish on the north side.
Yes, good morning. If we're going to be purging all things from the past, then we need to purge the movie Black Like Me, because that's where the man went in the South to see what it was like to make a report about how the black people, Negroes at that time, were being mistreated. Maybe we should purge all those kind of movies, which I think is insane.
Yeah.
The movie was very good. But you know what? Maybe this will be an awakening for the faithful Democrats, that they will face the facts about the Democrats' origins, that they dragged and hung Negroes back in the South. And maybe this will dredge up the memory that Martin Luther King was a Republican. Oh, maybe they'll wonder why.
Thank you, Trish. Appreciate the call. Very good. Mike in Geneva.
Hi, guys. I guess I lucked out as a kid because my favorite band was Kiss, and I dressed up as Ace Frehley with silver star face paint, so I can't be discriminated
again. I did Gene Simmons
but,
for years.
You know,
I wouldn't say either of you lucked out.
The whole point is everyone's saying it's about context and about mean-spiritedness.
Yeah.
And youthful, you know, if you're young, you do stupid things. What is the point where you're old enough to know better? Is it when you're in the workplace or, you know, I think it's all, you know, you have to understand it from that perspective. I give people a break, I'd say. And everyone should tell jokes about everybody else. That's the great equalizer. Puts us all on good footing.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. I mean, like, you know, I wanted to be like a rap star, and I used to try to dance like Flava Flav and wear a shower clock. Now I did do blackface or anything. But
I know. This all seems very foreign to me, this blackface thing.
By the way, I was a decent break dancer.
I know. Well, you're going to bring in your cardboard tomorrow and your parachute pants and spin around, right?
And I can almost, I don't know if I could still do it, but
could you?
I could. I mean, maybe me, Northam, and the Virginia AG should do a dance off, because I can almost. I think I can still do
the moonwalk.
Well, no, not the moonwalk. Like, that wasn't my thing. Michael Jackson was my thing. Public Enemy more my thing. So I can still do Flava Flav from 9-1-1 as a joke. I can do it almost perfectly, even without the top
hat. When we go on our Passport to Paradise, and by the way, you can sign up by going 560theanswer.com/passport. Will you do your dance down there?
Do my Flava Flav from 9-1-1.
Yeah.
9-1-1 is a joke. Maybe.
That would be.
Depends how much tequila I have.
Okay.
James in Westmont.
Oh, man. Just that visual dance.
Yeah, it's a great one, huh? And I'll do it in my, my Speedo, too, James, just to enhance it for you.
Oh, boy.
Now
please.
I got to be there.
Yeah.
Now I got to be there for that. How about NWA? How about we have these guys perform NWA? You think that would be racially insensitive?
NWA? Aren't they all like, thanks for the call, James. NWA?
They're in the home, but they're still.
No, yeah. NWA, they're like matinee sitcom stars now. What happened to Ice Cube? He's not a gangster rapper anymore. He's like got versions of the Full House. It just shows you people can change.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
I have people skills. I am good at dealing with people. Can't you understand that? What the hell is wrong with you people?
On AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so this series of columns at Gizmodo fascinated me. You've heard of the 12 Labors of Hercules. Well, what Gizmodo columnist Kashmir Hill did, I would say, is more difficult than capturing the Cretan Bill or cleaning out the Aegean stables. She gave up the Big Five, removed the Big Five from her life, each for a week: Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon. Could you do that? Would you want to even try? I wouldn't. So she has
couldn't survive.
She has sacrificed herself for all of us. I mean, like Facebook, you know, make a couple posts a day, but do I check it? Do I check the Twitter? Well, Twitter wasn't included, but Amazon. I watch everything on the streaming services.
Oh yeah, Amazon Video.
Google. I mean, it's not just Google the question machine. It's Google Maps, Google Calendars.
I don't know
Google
if we could
Documents.
Do a show without any of these.
So
I mean, Amazon, we can maybe do a show without.
So we're pleased to be joined by modern day hero Kashmir Hill. Kashmir, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Being called a modern Hercules is definitely the best introduction I've ever gotten. So thank you.
Well, I mean, the headlines say it all. I mean, I tried to block Amazon from my life. It was impossible. I cut Facebook out of my life. Surprisingly, I missed it. I cut Google out of my life. It screwed up everything. I cut Apple out of my life. It was devastating. I cut Microsoft out of my life, or so I thought. So it sounds like a painful 5 weeks for you.
It was incredibly difficult for me and for my family, my husband and my 2-year-old daughter. And it was actually 6 weeks because the final column hasn't come out yet.
It's when
I blocked all the tech giants for a week. And that comes out actually soon, like in a couple hours.
So what did you miss most? Amazon, Facebook, Google?
I think the hardest one was really Amazon, just because, you know, the way I was doing this, I wasn't just boycotting their products. I worked with a technologist who built a special tool for me that blocked my devices from being able to access these tech giant servers. So when I blocked Amazon, it took down Amazon Web Services, or AWS, which is a huge web hosting service that hosts so many websites and apps. It was incredible. And it took out all digital entertainment for me. So, you know, I couldn't listen to Spotify on the Amazon Echo we have in our house. And I couldn't watch Netflix, because even though Netflix is an Amazon competitor, they're hosted by AWS. We couldn't watch movies in our house or listen to music. So it was really silent. And it was harder to motivate myself to exercise, because I usually use those things as bait to get me to the gym.
And the Facebook, that would seem to be the easiest one to cut out. And it seemed to indicate that in your column that you thought it would be the easiest one. But I thought you made a really good point. It turned out not to be so easy, because I have built a social ecosystem on Facebook. And so I was disconnected from my social circle.
Right, because Facebook isn't just Facebook. It's Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. And I'm a huge Instagram user. And my whole network of my whole community, I'm connected to on Facebook and Instagram, and it's where I get news about everybody, and it's where I share my own news. So during the week that I was blocking Facebook, one of my closest friends had her baby, and I didn't know about it. And when I later re-enabled Facebook, I saw her baby had come, and I called her up, and I was like, congratulations, I wouldn't have known this. Well, I assume I would have checked in at some point to see if she popped, but I wouldn't have known it without Facebook. And she said, you know, I just assume when I put something on Facebook, everybody sees it. And so it was really hard to unplug from Facebook, just because they have such a monopoly on the social networks with some of the properties that they've bought.
Now, how did it change your relationship with your 2-year-old child and with your husband? Did you guys grow closer together, or was it, you know, as with all things, you know, a lot of agitation at first and then it got better?
Yeah, my husband wouldn't go all the way in on the block, because he said he has a real job and he has to be able to use the internet normally. Mm-hmm. For my 2-year-old, you know, she knows the word Alexa, though she pronounces it Alessa, and she missed having music in the house and being able to watch the movies that she likes. There's 3 movies she likes to watch. So she was frustrated, and because she's 2, I couldn't really explain to her why I was torturing her for my journalism. I would say, like, the overall effect for me was that by blocking the tech giants, because they control so much of the infrastructure of the internet and the web, it just forced me not to use technology altogether. And so it it made me look at screens less and just kind of be more focused on the people around me, such as my husband and my daughter. So overall, it was really good for us. It just made us like zone out less on television and go out to playgrounds more. I ever since I did the experiment, I look at my phone a lot less, and I just feel freed of technology to a certain extent, which I really appreciate.
Well, it's interesting because that's consistent with some of the studies that have come out recently, both about intellectual development of children who are spending too much time in front of a screen, and then just the happiness of adults who spend too much time, you know, obsessed with all of the different social media platforms.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we forget that the internet is only 20 years old, and sure, all these new technologies have changed the way we live so drastically. You kind of see it if you turn on the screen time reports on your smartphone and you realize how many hours you're looking at your phone every day and how many times you pick it up. And this is, you know, this is a new development in humanity. These are things we weren't doing 30 years ago. And I feel that there's a backlash right now where we realize, okay, maybe we've taken this too far, and this isn't a healthy relationship that we have with these technologies and these devices. And I hope other people kind of maybe do something. I hope no one does exactly what I did, because what I did was so painful. But oh, in terms of doing a kind of the digital equivalent of a juice cleanse and trying to pull back from these giants for a little while, and change your habits, I hope other people will do that too.
I think the canary in the coal mine for me was when Joaquin Phoenix was dating his operating system. I thought, okay, maybe we need to pull the reins on this a little bit.
So you said you have your last article coming out this week?
It comes out today, actually. Okay. So it'll go up on the Gizmodo site in a couple hours.
And so we've covered Amazon, Facebook. Microsoft. I thought I got Microsoft out of my life. Explain.
Yeah, I thought like, oh, I don't use many Microsoft products. Like, I don't have a Windows computer. I don't use Microsoft Office. I do use LinkedIn and Skype a lot, which Microsoft owns, but I figured I'd be okay without them for a week. And as a consumer, it wasn't that hard to avoid Microsoft, except every time I went anywhere to any business or used, you know, public transportation, I would look around and realize, oh, this is powered by Microsoft servers, because Microsoft is a business-to-business company.
Right.
And so they power a lot of these things on the back end, like some dated technologies that our governments are using are often showing Windows errors because they're powered by Microsoft. So I felt like I had avoided it in my computer use and my, you know, phone use, but just by moving through a city and paying for things and using services, I was encountering Microsoft, and it was hard to stop myself from doing that.
So the takeaway for the last 5 or 6 weeks is basically resistance is futile. We will be assimilated. Just submit to the Borg.
I hate conclusions like that. So I would say resistance isn't futile, and that we actually have to fight back, or, you know, these companies are really powerful and they'll continue to really control the way that we work, that we live, that we socialize. And so we have to be really intentional about resisting kind of the things they're pushing at us, because at the end of the day, they're making their money by making us stare at screens so they can, you know, monetize our attention, monetize our data. And so we should be aware of that in the backs of our minds, and I think try to change our behavior. And then I also think, you know, the government could do something about this and maybe regulate how powerful these companies are getting, and give us more control over our data as we're moving around online. Resistance is not futile. Okay. I hope that there's all right, a more positive takeaway.
All right. She is Kashmir Hill. She's a journalist at Gizmodo, Gizmodo Media. Tweet out her columns. Of course, I'm tweeting them out. I'm using social media.
Right, exactly.
But you've got to read these. A great detail on each one of the big five that you don't otherwise think about as you just utilize them in your day-to-day life. It's really interesting. Great columns. Appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Amy, you're familiar with the antinatalist movement, aren't you?
The anti what?
Antinatalist.
People against needles?
Natalist.
Oh.
An antinatalist.
Excuse me.
If that is such a thing.
We hate sewing.
plaintiff's attorneys, listen up. This will, I'm sure, start becoming popular in Cook County and the Metro East in no time. A 27-year-old Indian man from Mumbai is upset with his parents in a way. He has a great relationship with his parents. However, he does have a problem with them having given birth to him without his consent.
Where is he going with this?
That is akin to kidnapping and slavery.
Oh, gosh.
He believes it is wrong to put an unwilling child through the, quote, rigmarole of life for the pleasure of the parents. The antinatalist movement is gaining traction in India as younger people resist social pressure to have children. Raphael Samuel is his name. And though he says he has a great relationship with his parents, he also says that they're hypocrites. I love my parents and we have a great relationship, but they had me for their joy and their pleasure. My life has been amazing, but I don't see why I should put another life through the rigmarole of school and finding a career, especially when they didn't ask to exist. So this is going to be litigated. He wants to sue his parents for birthing him without his consent. Here's an exchange between him and his dad.
I'm asking you for help, and maybe I could sue for punitive damages that you're giving me.
I'm giving you?
Yes.
Me?
Yes.
What I do to you?
Well, punitive damages here.
It's an odd Indian accent that Raphael Samuel has, admittedly.
What I mean, that's going to be thrown out. That's not going to make it past summary judgment.
Not in Cook County. Cook County, we'd just be arguing about how much money the parents have to give the kid. And the same thing in Madison or St. Clair County,
I presume. That ungrateful, you know what? My kid ever sued me for that. Okay, bye-bye. See you later. Grab your things and go away.
Well, here's
pack up his room.
Here's a suggestion. If one of my imaginary kids said this to me, I would say, I'll tell you what, let's settle this out of court. You don't want to exist? I can accommodate that.
I brought you into this world. I could take you up.
Exactly.
I always say that to
We can end this rigmarole of your life. Not a problem. Why involve the attorneys? Get in the boat, Fredo. This is really something, isn't it? Yeah. If parents truly know, this is like this antinatalist movement. And if you're wondering, well, wait, how do you gain the fetus's consent, the baby's consent in utero for birth?
There's like something going through the fallopian tube?
I'm not sure.
Knock, knock, it's your uterine door. Answer it. I have some papers for you to sign.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds good.
But there are memes like the meme isn't forcing a child into this world and forcing it to have a career, kidnapping and slavery. The only reason your children are facing problems is because you had them. Well, that's true. You'd eliminate a lot of problems if you didn't exist. If parents truly know what is good for their children, why did they have them? Okay. All right. Interestingly, there's a book out by scientists called Empty Planet. There's this really good, I wanted to get this book review. There's this really good book review, Empty Planet, suggesting that actually we're going to be in a problem where the population is death spiraling, not just in specific countries that are not abiding replacement rate, but in the country writ large come 30 years from now. We don't have time to get to the book review, but it's just funny. This movement springing up, such as it is, and all of the ZPG types recasting arguments debunked 40 years ago. And now we see actually a problem coming on the other side, a demographic problem on the other side that we'll discuss on another show.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.